You've been.
I've been out transforming healthcare.
Let's call to order the meeting of the House Rules Committee. It's Thursday, June 2nd, 2011. Welcome, everyone. We've got, as is always true with the Rules Committee, a great diversity of bills on completely different topics from each other. I know we have a lot of folks here on 3657. We've got a couple of members here on two bills. So maybe for the benefit of, if it makes sense to Representative Compton, Senator Bonamici, maybe we'll open up those two, let the two of you testify, and then recess them and come back to the bill and pick up the rest of the testimony later. So why don't we begin, with Representative Compton. Let's open up a public hearing. So we're just changing the plan. I just told you, let's do open up a public hearing on House Bill 3474.
Mr. Chairman, Victoria Cox is here for that. I would like to point out that we're resupplied with Kleenex. Thanks to Victoria here in the hearing room.
It was a personal need of mine.
We also did have someone crying at our last committee hearing. I don't think Representative Compton's going to cry about this bill, but
please.
Could I ask if Dean Hicks could come up here with me?
Yes, that would be fine. Go ahead, Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3474A directs preparation of plan to encourage national board certification for teachers and administrators, requires creation of comprehensive leadership development system for administrators, renames professional organization certification fund as national board certification fund, and sets purpose of fund to promote national certification of teachers and administrators, creates educator preparation improvement fund to improve preparation of teachers and administrators, directs preparation of guidelines for uniform set of performance evaluation methods for teachers, establishes reporting and implementation timeline, declares an emergency effective on passage. We have A-A4 amendments, which Representative Comp is going to address, I believe, and we have received several items of written testimony that have been saved to the chair drive.
Okay, great. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betty Comp. I represent House District 22, which includes the communities of Woodburn, Jervis, as well as Northeast Salem. I just wanted to make sure I don't forget this. I can be here tomorrow if you want to do a work session on this. So you didn't laugh.
You're getting several thumbs up on that. Keep on going.
Okay. Before you today is House Bill 3474, which would create the Educator Preparation Improvement Fund. This fund would exist in order to respond to the inevitable changes in Oregon's education system. Help education entities collaborate and create effective delivery systems for professional development. This is about helping our teachers. And the other thing is it would set up the fund for national board certification. It has been proven, it's been around long enough, that teachers that have national board certification, their students excel is just really remarkable. They move them to a high percentage of success. And yet, this is a very expensive program to get in, as most things are. And so we wanted to be able to have a small fund to help, particularly in new teachers in training, to have an exposure to those, what that national certification looks like. Colleagues, I've been a teacher, principal in both roles. I have seen and witnessed the value and need of professional development. And beyond professional development, the skills that our colleges and universities are giving our teachers when they start out. We had a work group that was made up of deans and teachers from private and public universities, and get to work together to create this plan. Dean Hicks will tell you a little bit more about that. The one thing that I would share as an equal importance is the fact that the preparation for school administrators. It is like any other profession in this world these days. There's lots of people retiring, and the knowledge that we need to be a good administrator continues to grow. We have a tough budget environment. We know that. We know that we need to spend every dollar wisely and know that it is being spent for our students and our teachers. This bill is a work product from a task force that Dean Hitz will talk about, but you will hear others. You have written testimony, and we are here to answer any questions, but I'm going to be brief and end there so that if you have questions, and welcome Representative Olson, co-chair. Missed you.
Thank you. Please proceed. Welcome.
Yes, co-chairs Hunt and Olson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Randy Hitz. I'm the dean of the Graduate School of Education at Portland State University, and as Representative Kopp indicated, I had the privilege of serving as the chair of the House Bill 3619 task force, which you created a year ago. The purpose of that task force was to have us make recommendations to you about how to basically improve the teaching profession, how to create a seamless system so we're preparing the profession all the way from recruiting great people into the profession, preparing them well, helping them in the induction years, and helping them throughout their careers. So what you'll see in this bill are a number of items that address full continuum for teachers. There's an element that provides for improved teacher preparation and other elements that are for helping teachers as they advance in their careers. A little bit more background into this, the House Bill 3619 Task Force actually also grew out of another effort that started about a year earlier, and that was the Oregon Coalition for Quality Teaching and Learning, of which Representative Kopp is also a part and has been a great leader with that. That group is mentioned in this bill that you're looking at right now, because they will continue to exist and exert leadership. The purpose of that group, and it is a broad coalition which includes public school people, university folks, teachers, school administrators, it includes school board members, community leaders, as well as policymakers. And the purpose of that group is basically to help us find ways to improve the teaching profession. Again, creating a seamless system and a way to help teachers become more effective and school administrators become more effective. And so that's the essence of the bill that's before you right now, and I'll be happy to answer questions about it.
Thank you. Questions for our witnesses? Representative Burr.
Yes, thank you. The dashboards do what? Are you the proposers of the dashboards?
Yes, but it's awful. I didn't bring a copy in front of me. But
I think our administrator.
You have a copy of the A4 amendments, the 3474.
It defines the Oregon Coalition for Quality Teaching and Learning.
Thank you.
My question is this: does it change the fiscal on the bill?
No, it does not change the fiscal on the bill. What the amendment is a collaboration of working with two of the main supporters of this work has been the Chalkboard Project and the OEA, and this is a combination of the way. Both entities believe that the language should stay in support of the teachers. That's what this is. It is. It's all about terminology and words.
And it doesn't change the fiscal.
No.
Thank you. That's the crux of my problem, or my question.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you both very much. We appreciate being here. Since we only have two other folks to testify on this bill, let's go ahead and wrap up this hearing completely. If we could have, I think I saw Hannah Vandering walk in, yes, and Dana Hepper is right there. Great.
Thank you, committee.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Kopp. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
I don't care. Go for it. Okay.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, and members of the committee, my name is Hannah Vandering. I'm an elementary physical education teacher and proudly serve as the vice president of the Oregon Education Association, and I'm here to speak on behalf of House Bill 3474. As Representative shared earlier, we've been working collaboratively with education stakeholders on House Bill 3619 Task Force, and we support the recommendations that have come out of that and that you will see in this House bill. We believe the passage of this will help us reach our vision at the Oregon Education Association, which is to improve the future of all Oregonians through quality public education. I can speak today on behalf of my experience as an educator in the Beaverton School District and as an advocate for our members across the state and the area of evaluation and the other components of this bill. I was privileged to have a supervising teacher who was a master teacher and had a huge impact on my experience in the gym and as an educator in Beaverton. And it was incredible to have someone who really took the time and energy to make sure I had the tools necessary. I've also had the opportunity to work with four administrators, and I'd like to share my experience because it's varied under those four administrators in the evaluation process. One of my evaluators followed the evaluation process to a T. Every letter was crossed, and we had all of the meetings scheduled, and we had conversations about how I could improve as an educator and what I could do to make sure all of the students that walked into my gym were successful. That was a meaningful experience, and it made a real impact on my teaching experience. One of the administrators that I worked under, I received a note in my box that the evaluation was due tomorrow. Could I please come in and sign my evaluation to make sure that we met the timelines that were required by the district? Well, that was much easier to not have the meetings and go through the process. It was disrespectful to not only my students, but to myself as an educator to help me improve. And unfortunately, that's a process that is seen across the state. The implementation of this will ensure that we have quality evaluation programs that really help us improve public education here in Oregon. So I hope that as you look at this, you will strongly consider that area. There's also a few other areas that I'd like to speak to. Section 2, the preparation fund, the Educator Preparation Fund, working together with the colleges and universities to make sure that we have placements that are meaningful for the educators and supervising teachers that have a passion for helping new educators come into our profession is important. Also, providing quality collaboration time for them to talk about the lessons that they have taught, both the supervising teacher and the new educator, so that they have reflected back on their teaching and what's happened and how they can make sure that the next lesson is even more effective, will help all of our educators. The creation of the leadership development system for administrators, as outlined in Section 3, is a huge piece of this bill. We put a lot of emphasis on creating the evaluation tool, and we don't put a lot of emphasis on making sure that it is implemented properly. Our administrators need our support. They need to make sure they have not only the training to implement the evaluation tool, but the time built into their schedule to make sure that they follow through with each and every educator that is in their building so that they have given them feedback to help them be successful. So we look forward to making sure that that piece is truly honored and that those administrators have the training and the time that they need in order to implement that. Nationally, board certification has been proven to be an effective tool to help educators make sure that they're providing a quality education to each of our students. So Section 6 outlines a fund in order to help our educators become board certified. I've talked with many board certified teachers, not only from Oregon but across the nation, who say that their experience that they've had going through that program really has impacted their ability to make sure that each and every child has all of the lessons differentiated to meet their needs. So we encourage that component of this bill. And finally, I want to speak to the the teaching standards that have been adopted that are extremely important to us to make sure that those are shared out with our educators across the state. so that they know what those standards are and can implement those with their students. I'm proud of the fact that many of our local associations have been working collaboratively with their districts on evaluation tools. They've taken their time and energy. I know in Beaverton, we spent over 3 years creating a quality evaluation tool. We spent a lot of our time and energy making sure that that was effective. And there are other districts who've been doing that as well, but the passage of this bill will ensure that we have all districts putting in that time and effort that will make a difference for our students. So I thank you for your time and encourage you to support this House bill.
Thanks, Anna.
Hi, my name is Dana Hepper. I'm the Advocacy Director with Stand for Children, and I can't describe the legislation any better than Representative Comp and Dean Hitz did, but I wanted to just zoom out really quickly and say this. Inside the school building, teachers and principals matter most in terms of how much students learn. They matter more than class size. Teachers and principals matter more than the condition of the school building, more than electives that we offer. They matter more than anything else. And so if we do anything to improve outcomes for students, it should be to provide the best support and training and accountability possible for our principals and our teachers. We have work to do on that front in this state. I think we all know that. We have work to do on professional development, on evaluations, on time for collaboration. And the preparation fund specifically, I think, begins to tackle the front end of our principal and teacher pipeline, getting the best candidates to apply to our colleges of education, ensuring we have a diverse pool of applicants entering the profession that mirror the population of students we have in our classrooms, and training them effectively with real life experience that's going to make them ready to do the job once they're in there. That's all. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions for either witness? Hannah and Dana, you guys should travel together. Hannah and Dana. Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. We will, I don't see anyone else signed up to testify on that one. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3474 and look forward to coming back to that before the end of session. I think we'll go ahead and do Senate Bill 670, invite Senator Bonamici up next. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 670. Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 670 defines school types for purpose of federal loan forgiveness programs offered to teachers, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage.
Welcome, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you very much. Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, committee members, thank you very much for scheduling a hearing on Senate Bill 670. I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 670, which is short, simple, has no fiscal, I believe it has no amendments, and it's, besides that, very good policy. This issue came to the attention of myself and the other sponsors and co-sponsors when we were attending a meeting of the Beaverton School District. It was a legislative meeting where they were talking about issues of concern, and one of the principals raised her hand at the end and said, "Well, some of our middle school teachers are very concerned about something that's happened. They've applied for loan forgiveness under a federal loan forgiveness program, and they were denied, and they were very confused about that because it was their understanding they would qualify." So there's a federal teacher loan forgiveness program that's designed to encourage teachers to teach in elementary and secondary school programs that serve low-income students. The problem was that under the Oregon statutes, middle schools were not considered secondary schools, so it was simply a matter of semantics. So we contacted the Department of Education and said, this is a problem because our middle school teachers would otherwise be eligible, but because of the way middle schools are not defined as secondary schools, or secondary schools do not include middle schools in the definition, they're being denied loan forgiveness. So the Department of Education looked at it, they got back to us and said, we can fix this, and hence we have Senate Bill 670. And so we actually contacted Senator Wyden's office to make sure that if the teachers were reapplying, they would qualify. We're pretty certain that that will work. It doesn't seem to be controversial. It simply defines secondary schools to include middle schools, and this will help our teachers who otherwise believe that they would qualify. I encourage your support. Thank you for holding this hearing, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. President Berger.
Senator Does this mean that if you are teaching in a K-8 and you're teaching 6 and 7, you wouldn't qualify for this program?
I don't think that will happen. Kindergarten through grade 12 or any part thereof.
Okay.
I believe it was intended to deal with the situations. It was drafted to deal with the situations where there's a K-8 or a 6-12 or that type of school.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to.
I appreciate that.
There's this other category over there.
Right. I think this is drafted so that it will capture that.
Thank you.
Well, I don't know. I don't
Thank
care
you
about
for
that.
These two. Well,
seeing no other. I'm sorry, Representative.
I just wanted to thank the Senator for bringing this bill forward. Thank you.
You're welcome. Appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Great. Why don't you just stay there, and we only have two other witnesses on this one. Let's just go ahead.
Okay.
Or you may leave, either way.
I believe the teachers are here. I'd be happy to
Jamie
stay.
And Stephen, if you want
to
come up, since these are your constituents, I assume.
Stephen and school district teachers, though.
Okay. At least until redistricting, they're yours.
They may still be.
Welcome to the Rules Committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Hi, I'm Stephen Duvall. I'm currently a 8th grade science teacher at Five Oaks Middle School in the Beaverton School District. I've been teaching there for 4 years and will be eligible for this loan forgiveness program after the following year. Basically, Senator Bonamici hit all the points on what this bill is and what it's about, but I'll give you a little background on what happened to me and my coworker on finding out about not being qualified. But basically, I went into Ms. Cooper's office one day, and she was telling me about this loan forgiveness program. I said, that's great. I know I qualify. And then she said, well, I was turned down. And I said, well, how's that so? Our degrees say secondary teachers on them. And she got a letter back saying that because the state of Oregon does not consider grades 6 through 8 as secondary schools, that she was not eligible for the highly qualified math and science secondary teacher loan forgiveness, which is $17,500. She was only eligible for $5,000 of that. So I thought, well, this affects me. So I called ODE and said that it was a common theme throughout the state that there were a lot of other teachers at a lot of other buildings that ran into the same problem. And I actually went on to the Federal Loan Forgiveness Program website and saw all the qualifying schools and found that between 500 and 600 schools in the state of Oregon, schools qualify for the loan forgiveness program. So any of the math and science teachers at those schools could potentially gain in getting that loan forgiveness. And basically, this program, I feel, was designed to get the best highly qualified teachers into the schools that need them the most.
Right.
And if this bill passes, then I think that's one more tool that we'll have to get teachers where we need them to be to get math and science up there and get the kids the support that they need for those subjects. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Welcome.
I'm Jamie Cooper. I also work at Five Oaks Middle School in Beaverton. I was going to read this, but I just wanted to share with you our story. I learned about loan forgiveness in Atlanta. I did AmeriCorps. I volunteered at a low-income school and found out about this program, and I was very excited because I wanted to teach middle school, and I was excited that I could teach and have my loans forgiven. And so I came to Oregon and got a job at Five Oaks, which is 1,000 or 1,100 students. It's 60% free and reduced lunch, 28% mobility. You know, it's a challenging school to work at, but I love my job. I love that I work there. I love that my kids need a lot of help. And I feel like every day they come to school and we work through whatever, and they make growth and they improve on their state test scores despite their backgrounds and how hard the job can be. So I knew about this program, and I rushed to do my master's degree so that I could qualify my loans for my master's degree with this program. And then I finished my fifth year of teaching. I was super excited. I went to apply for the loan program and got my first response back when they forgave $5,000, which any teacher K through 12 that is working at a low-income school qualifies for. But I was expecting the $17,500, and the letter said that I've been denied because Oregon the state of Oregon does not consider middle schools to be secondary schools. And since there were only two categories to check on the application, secondary or elementary, I clearly didn't think I fit in the elementary category. And so I was shocked and a little disappointed and sort of didn't know what to do. So I'm glad that at this point it's been brought up, it's passed through the Senate, and we're hopeful that it can be passed into law. Because I think, as Stephen said, we really need to get highly qualified teachers and teachers that want to be in these low-income schools like ours. And I feel like this bill encourages teachers to do that and rewards teachers who would work there anyway. So I appreciate you taking the time to listen to our stories. Because it means a lot, and we know things are rough, but we appreciate the time.
We appreciate your time. Thanks for coming down. Any questions, Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we know if there is a timeline, a time limit on when applications for this kind of loan forgiveness can be made, or does this federal law disappear at some point, or do we know?
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, and Representative Barnhart, I don't know if there's a time limit. I believe that this program has been around for a while. I don't think it's a temporary program.
And then if I could, Mr. Chair, just a quick comment. The fact, of course, is that the states, including Oregon, have done a very poor job of supporting higher education. When I was a student, it was possible to work a summer job and work part-time during the school year, pay your tuition and room and board without borrowing any money. Now, of course, that's utterly impossible, and so all students, pretty much, unless they have parents who can support them, come out of school with student loans to pay, and I think this is a great program. We ought to do everything we can to make sure that they can take advantage of it.
Well, this bill just gets better and better, though, with the two Falcons in the room. As a fellow Falcon, I appreciate you being here.
Aren't they
five folks in the house?
Aren't they in a competitive league with your current constituents?
Well, yeah, no,
yeah.
Rush past that.
I don't think there's an expiration. I've applied many times because I thought maybe if I applied a third time it would get through, but it didn't. But they never said, you're done, stop applying. Sometimes they just send me another application. So I don't think there are. And it's been around since 97. So.
Great. I'm not seeing Representative Holby. I'm sorry.
Just one question. I'm just curious. Does the federal program define what the Title I schools are? I mean, that's not something the state does. That's something the federal program does.
Co-chairs, Representative Holby. Yes, there is on the website. There is a list. You can go to the state, and then there'll be a list that you can either download on Excel or pop up in a new tab that'll tell you all the schools that qualify under the loan forgiveness program. And if you have to work at one of those schools for five consecutive years to qualify.
Thanks.
And co-chairs and committee, I just wanted to add, however, that the definition of what is a secondary school depends on state law, which
right.
is why we
have
to.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Hence the bill.
Yeah. Thank you all. We appreciate all being here.
Thanks
very much. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 670 and open a work session on Senate Bill 670.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Weir.
Just because it's got a 5-0 connection, I would move the Senate Bill 670. Make sure I do it right. 670 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Weir moves Senate Bill 670 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, Amy, please call the roll.
Representative Colby?
Aye.
Representative
Weir? Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Excuse.
Co-Chair Olson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt?
Aye. Motion carries. And I was just looking at the House sponsors of the bill. Actually, maybe Representative Harker is one of the sponsors from Beaverton. Okay. We'll ask Representative Harker to carry that. If Victoria, if you can follow up on that, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
Perfect. Close the work session on Senate Bill 670, and we will open a work session on House Bill 3657. As Jim comes back, this is a, why don't you go ahead and brief us on what 3657 is and the amendments, and then we'll talk about how to proceed.
Mr. Chairman, this is 3657, House Bill 3657. It reduces Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission non-resident commercial fishing fees to no more than $50 more than resident fees. You have the dash one that you've had for a while that allows the commission to charge the correct fee for the fishing area that the license is good for, regardless of when the license is renewed. We have today the dash 3 amendment, which prohibits gillnet fishing in Lower Columbia River from March 1st through May 31st of each year, except in off-channel fishery enhancement areas specified by rule of the Fish and Wildlife Commission, and that is, becomes effective January 1st, 2012, declares emergency effective upon passage. We have asked for revenue and fiscal analysis on each of these, and I have copies of the fiscal analysis on the dash three if you would like to see it. I'll distribute those.
Is it fair to say the fiscal analysis on the dash three is no different than the fiscal analysis on the base bill, because the lost revenue impact is related to the fee change, not related to the stuff in the dash threes? Am I right on that?
I think that's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the dash ones are the emergency clause that we talked about when we heard the bill before.
Right, correct. So we are in a work session, not a formal public hearing, but we've asked proponents and opponents of the Dash 3 amendments to identify some spokespeople, and so I've got a list of three, and then there's at least one legislator. It's okay with you, we'll do the three proponents, three opponents, and then you got a little bit of time? Okay, then we'll give you a chance to speak as well. So let's, and there may be another legislator who I didn't see. Okay, so we'll give them both a chance. So the three proponents, let's bring forward Dave Shamp, Jack Glass, and Jim Martin. You're all three here, great. That's correct. Welcome to the Rules Committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed in whichever order you prefer.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee. I'm going to start by saying that the information that I was provided with regard to the Dash 3 Amendment showed different dates. So my testimony reflects those dates, actually January to July. So I just want to let you know that I'm not trying to pull a fast one, but that was the information that I had. So again, co-chairs of the committee, thank you for holding today's hearing and providing the opportunity to voice support for House Bill 3657. My name is Dave Shamp, and I'm the chairman of the board for the Oregon chapter of the Coastal Conservation Association. Representing 17 coastal states and over 100,000 members, CCA has an unparalleled track record of putting conservation first and successfully battling for sustainable fisheries. Established in 2008, the Washington and Oregon chapters became the fastest growing chapters in the CCA's 34-year history. That unprecedented growth was fueled primarily by one issue: harvest reform on the Columbia River. In just 3 years, over 15,000 members have joined, and their number one priority is to eliminate the impacts of non-selective commercial harvest, gillnets and tanglenets, on non-target salmon, steelhead, and sturgeon. The evidence clearly shows that gillnets and tanglenets inflict a high rate of mortality on non-target wild and ESA-listed salmon and steelhead. Eliminating those impacts is paramount. The National Marine Fisheries Service estimates that about 450 distinct salmon and steelhead runs have already disappeared. Over half of the Columbia's historic salmon and steelhead runs are already extinct. Currently, the Columbia River is home to 13 species listed under the ESA. The congressionally established Hatchery Scientific Review Group recommended the selective harvest of hatchery fish as a key element to wild salmon recovery. The use of gillnets and tanglenets in the Columbia River results in an unacceptably high incidence of bycatch. Recent observer data from the summer Chinook mainstem gillnet fishery, this is last year's summer gillnet gill net fishery showed that for every target Chinook that was harvested, one non-target species was also caught and discarded. Observer data also shows that tangle nets used in the main stem spring fishery catch and result in the loss of large numbers of ESA-listed steelhead. The Columbia's white sturgeon numbers are declining at an alarming rate, and eliminating the main stem gill netting would reduce non-target commercial encounters with white sturgeon by 95%. The good news is there's an option. Recent experience shows that the commercial fisheries executed in the off-channel safe areas are successful. In fact, they are experiencing record results. In 2010, the gillnet fishery caught nearly 25,000 spring Chinook in the safe areas. An additional 80,000 coho and Chinook were taken in those same areas during the fall fisheries. The combined total of those fisheries was greater than the entire Columbia River, lower Columbia River, recreational harvest. CCA Oregon views eliminating main stem non-selective commercial harvest as the most critical step in reducing its harmful impacts on our imperiled salmon and steelhead. And passage of House Bill 3657 would achieve that important milestone. Time and area restrictions are common fisheries management practices used both for the commercial and recreational sector. Historical catch data shows that limiting the gill nets to the safe areas from January to July, again, I apologize for the dates, would impact or reduce the gill net landings by less than 5%. And it would most importantly remove the gill nets from the path of 77% of our ESA-listed runs that migrate through the river during that time frame. CCA strongly encourages your support of House Bill 3657. Again, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Jack or Jim, whichever you prefer.
Okay. My name is Jack Glass. I live in Troutdale, Oregon, on Columbia River Highway. I've been a full-time fishing guide in that area for some time. I'm here to tell you my story. I belong to many active groups, such as Northwest Steelheaders, and representing the sport fishing industry. This is a fun thing that we've got in the state of Oregon, and we do our best to represent that. My father was a full-time guide in the 60s to early 70s. I started guiding in the early 80s. My son now, a full-time fishing guide as well, the past 6 years. We have three generations of full-time guiding activity in our family. I also do a lot of volunteer work with the state of Oregon. I just left State Marine Board this morning. I'm on the Guide Advisory Committee with the State Marine Board. I'm also on the board of the R&E program for the state of Oregon, where $4 out of angling licenses goes into a budget that we spend on fish projects, youth benefit, handicap fishing, things like that. Thank you very much for supporting the R&E program. So I put a lot of effort into these resources in volunteer time, because I always felt if you put something into it, you can get something out of it. And being as I make a living at this fishing industry, I really put a lot of time into this stuff. And with the fluctuating fisheries in the springtime, it's really difficult for my son and I to manage our opportunities for fishing to people out of town that we bring into the state of Oregon to spend time with us to enjoy the fishing on the Columbia River that potentially is there. We have restrictive seasons. It makes it difficult to schedule these people to make commitments to come into these fisheries. So it does mean a lot to us to support Bill 3657 and able to allow us to book these trips to bring people into the area. They spend a lot of money. I even have people come out of Seattle Market, and they'll bring their own boats and come down and stay in hotels, buy tackle from the retailers in the area, gasoline, restaurants, everything. So it boosts the economy enormously. I visually see that because of the folks that we bring into the area. So I'm asking you to please support this bill. That means a lot to my livelihood. There's no question about it.
Thank you. Welcome, Jim.
Co-chairs Hunt and Olson, members of the committee. My name is Jim Martin. I'm a professional fish biologist for 43 years here in Oregon. I served 30 years for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, retiring as chief of fisheries. I've given you some written testimony with quite a bit of history on this conflict. I've been dealing and managing this conflict all my life, and it's getting worse. It's not getting better. I'd like to just kind of boil my testimony down to three things that you commonly hear relating to this Dash 3 proposal to restrict commercial gill netting to the safe areas the first part of the year, the most valuable part of the year for the recreational fishery, the most valuable part of the year for the economy as a whole, and the place where the two fisheries compete the most directly head for head in terms of stability of seasons and the overall economy. We support House Bill 3657 with the Dash 3 amendments, which encapsulates the Safe for Salmon concept. The first thing you're going to hear is, well, you're trying to put the gill netters out of business. No gill netter will lose his job, nor any commercial processor will lose any jobs over this particular shift in policy. We're talking about a maximum of 5% reduction in overall gill net catch. I maintain that it will be swamped by the increase in gillnet catch caused by the return of the 40% increase in baby salmon that are actually being released right now in the safe areas to return. The safe areas are going to continue to be a huge windfall for the commercial side of the equation. The question is whether we will continue to limit main stem recreational fisheries in order to allocate 40% more of the ESA impacts for main stem gillnet fisheries on top of these rapidly increasing safe area fisheries. So no gill netter is going to lose their job over this policy. People who tell you that, in my opinion, are not being particularly honest with you. The second thing you're going to hear is safe areas are so crowded, there are mud flats at the low tide, gee whiz, we just can't catch any more fish there. Well, they're catching 100,000 fish there now, a year, of all species. Obviously, they're not fishing at low tide when it's a mud flat. They're fishing at high tide when the fish flood in there. It's an extremely successful fishery. And adding 40% more smolts when the states proposed to do that, no gill netter said, please don't add any more fish there. We can't catch them now. In fact, these are extremely successful fisheries. They can be managed. If there's excessive crowding there, the states always have the opportunity to platoon the fishery where odd permits fish on odd days and even permits fish on even days. There are all kinds of techniques to deal with the crowding issue. The fundamental issue here is an extremely effective way and place to catch hatchery fish and add market value and add income to the commercial sector without burning up ESA impacts, without limiting the recreational fishery and the overall economy in the main stem. People who tell you these fisheries are unmanageable and will be unmanageable under the Dash 3 amendments, in my opinion, are not being perfectly honest with you. The third thing you're going to hear is, well, these economics are so fuzzy, gee whiz, you just can't use them to make allocations. We can't really figure out what the most value is. That's just not true. The fact of the matter is that an objective economic allocation is the most, analysis is the most scientific way of judging what's best for the policy, for the state, for the economy as a whole. Of course, when you have reallocations, you have winners and you have losers. I've been through a number of them as a professional fish biologist. And the way to do this is to look beyond the individuals that are involved at the broader economy and the amount of jobs which will be carried by the number of fish that you have available. Economic analysis is, in fact, the most common and the most objective way of determining when and how much reallocation is necessary and what's best for the policy of the state or in the country and the region as a whole. So to wrap up, the bottom line is Oregon is growing. It's growing very, very rapidly, and it's growing more rapidly, and the demand for these fish, both on the sport and commercial side, is growing more rapidly than the supply is. So the question comes down to a policy not of managing based on the past, but looking forward and asking yourself, what's the best policy for the future? These Dash 3 amendments comprise a really good compromise. They substantially enhance jobs and economic assurance and certainty in the recreational side, which is key to our tourist economy, without damaging gill nets much at all, in my opinion. And it will help resolve this conflict, which has been growing more and more difficult each year. Unless we take some policy movement ahead, some leadership ahead, this policy will come back time and time and time again with just more energy and more energy and more energy, pitting Oregonians against Oregonians. So this isn't about the good guys and the bad guys. It's about what is a good policy for our future, anticipating the growth and the needs of Oregon's economy in the future. Thank you very much for having me, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, all three. Questions for these witnesses? Is that a question? No, okay. All right, we appreciate you all three being here. Thanks for your testimony.
Thank you again.
Let's bring up as the second panel, Bruce Buckmaster, Jim Wells, and Kerry Johnson. Great. Welcome to the Rules Committee. Thanks for being here. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed in whatever you'd like.
Co-Chair Hunt, and I guess Co-Chair Olson, if he's not present, and rest of the representatives. My name's Jim Wells from Astoria, Oregon. I'm a lifetime commercial fisherman. I'm also the Salmon for All president in Astoria. That's a volunteer position. I make my living totally from commercial fishing, raise my family, and I always have. I'm also a member of the Columbia River Advisory Group to the state of Oregon, and that helps the managers set seasons and just input from the commercial industry. So I serve on that. The first point that needs to be made, and it's very important, is that Amendment 3 to Bill 3657, we have no problem with 3657. It's the Amendment 3 that's the problem for us. And that amendment has absolutely nothing to do with conservation. All fisheries, commercial, sport, and tribal, are impact-driven and tightly controlled through the Federal Endangered Species Act. And the managers manage through the Endangered Species Act. They're under the thumb of the federal government, and nobody wants to exceed impacts. The conservation is in the ESA and is tightly monitored. The recreational fishery has more than ample opportunity at present time to fish in very meaningful and productive mainstem fisheries. They have more mainstem opportunity and fish allocated to them than they can presently utilize. The 2010 summer season is a good example. They fish 7 days a week for 6 weeks straight. That's the time frame of summer season. They had a full 6 weeks. They ended up catching about half their quota. The rest went uncaught. So far, 2011 spring season, I talked to state managers yesterday. They probably will not catch their quota in this spring season. And they are allocated 82% of that upriver spring run. The split is 82 sport, 18 commercial. And like I said, they probably will not catch their quota by the time June 15th comes around and the summer season starts. They have 100% of the steelhead. Both states spend a lot of money raising steelhead in the hatcheries. They have 100% of that, except for what few of the treaty tribes catch above the dam. And they're constrained by ESA limits up there as well. And so they don't catch a lot of them. When you figure that there was over 400,000 of them in the run last summer, over 400,000 steelhead went by. Commercial can't sell any of them. They got 80% of the sturgeon locked up. We have 20%. Be about 3,400 this year for the commercial industry to put out for the consumer. They also have 100% of the tributary fisheries. Very lucrative fisheries. The Willamette's a big one. It's got 100,000 fish forecast for this spring. You got Wind River, you got Drano Lake on the Washington side. Those are their two big ones. Very, very good fisheries for the sport fishery. Taxpaying general public, that's the consumer, has a right to a share of the Columbia River mainstem fish. They help fund the federal hatcheries through taxes and pay through electric bills for dam mitigation for fish passage. The 100,000 fish they're talking about that we caught in select areas last year. That's an accurate number. That is. And that was a great season. But we're here today talking about spring and summer fish. We're not talking about fall fish. This amendment takes us off the river for the spring time frame, and that is our most valuable fish. Fish are way less valuable in the fall. They're not as good a quality, and there's a lot of other fish coming in from Alaska in that time frame. So the early fish, first on the market, top quality, high dollar. An example of that is our springers are worth $5 to $7, $8 a pound when we're fishing spring salmon. About half the Chinook we caught last fall, we caught 20,000. And 10 was a big creek hatchery harvest of tules. They're 50 to 70 cents a pound commercial value. They're worth 10% of what a springer's worth. And we also caught about 60,000 coho in select areas. And they're an 8 or 9 pound fish at about $1.25 a pound. They're a $10 fish. So of the 100, 80,000 was fall fish. And we had a great spring season. We had over 20,000 springers, and we're very thankful for that. It helped our community greatly. But if you kick out last year and look at the five previous years and look at a five-year average, the average in our select areas for spring salmon is about 4,500 fish. That 20,000-plus springers last year was a real anomaly. The state managers don't know where it came from. We don't know where it came from. And it's not happening this year. This year, that fishery's winding down. It's just a trickle right now. It's about over. And we're about 7,000 fish. And we beat the average, but it's about a third of last year's anomaly. So you can't count on a year like that all the time in selects. We came down and testified in the Senate side on Senate Bill 736, which would have put us into select areas. And also present were representatives from the treaty tribes. And that was Bruce Jim and Only Platt Jr., members of the Warm Spring Tribes, adamantly object to this to that bill and to take the main stem commercial fishery away. Many different reasons. I won't go into them all today. Marketing's one of them. Monitoring of the sport fishery is another one. There's a lot of reasons why. But their testimony was that they had a strong objection to putting us in selects only. One of the senators asked them point blank, there's rumor that if you take the gillnet fishermen off the main stem, the tribal fishermen are going to come down. And their response was, our agreement right now is gentlemen's agreement is we stay above the dam. The non-Indian commercial guys stay below the dam. We stay above it in zone 6. If the commercial guys are taken off the main stem, that deal's off the table, and we will consider our actions from that point forward. They did not rule out coming down and filling the void if we're gone. And that's something I don't think any of us really want to see. Amendment Dash 3 is a very thinly veiled attempt to eliminate the Columbia River commercial fishermen and seriously hurt lower river rural communities. Please vote no on this amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the Rules Committee. If you could pull a mic over toward you.
Thanks.
Introduce yourself for the record.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Kerry Johnson, and I'm a fourth-generation commercial fisherman from Astoria. And my family has been fishing on the Columbia River since the early 1900s. It's the reason why my family settled in Oregon and in Astoria. Much like America's farmers, commercial fishermen provide a food source for the consumer, and we take pride in what we do. We work hard to deliver the highest quality product that we can to the grocery stores, restaurants, and fish markets, and ultimately to your dinner plate. Columbia River salmon is the finest salmon that you can find anywhere in the world. I consider myself an expert in that. I've traveled to Alaska and British Columbia and had salmon from all over the West Coast, and you won't find a better salmon than a spring Chinook salmon out of the Columbia River. If the Dash 3 amendments that have been proposed were to pass, this bill would immediately end the oldest and continuing industry in the Pacific Northwest. The proposed amendments confine commercial fishermen to certain tiny side channel areas that are simply too small to support our commercial fleet. These areas were developed by commercial fishermen and provide a good supplement to our main stem fishery, but they can never take its place. And there is a secret to being a successful fisherman. and that is that you have to fish where the fish are. And the main stem of the Columbia River is where the fish are. My small business will not be able to survive if we are removed from our traditional fishing grounds, and it will not be economically feasible to continue in the industry that has supported my family and many others for generations. My son will not have the same opportunity that I have had to earn a living. This bill would be devastating to fishermen, our families, and our communities, and all people that enjoy eating salmon. Hundreds of jobs would be destroyed, and with double-digit unemployment rates in my area, we can't afford to lose any more jobs. Less than 6% of Oregonians are recreational salmon fishermen, and yet this amendment would shift 100% of the mainstem spring Chinook harvest to the recreational side. The state of Oregon would be in serious jeopardy of losing federal funding that supports its hatcheries, and since the Columbia River is co-managed between Oregon and Washington, Washington commercial fishermen would continue to fish on the mainstem, and Oregon fishermen would be out of business. Oregonians want to purchase sustainably harvested local products, and Columbia River salmon is the finest food that nature can provide. We are hardworking fishermen, we are earning an honest living, and we want to be able to pass on our way of life to the next generation. We welcome recreational fishermen and the jobs that they provide, and there's room on the Columbia River for all. We need to work together to increase the abundance of salmon so we can all benefit: the salmon, the seafood consumer, the tribes, recreational fishermen, and commercial fishermen. The amendment to the bill selfishly demands that one group would get placed into an area where they simply could not survive. It is unfair, it would destroy jobs, and should not be supported, and I ask the committee to reject this idea and leave this amendment out of the bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you, Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Buckmaster. I'm a sport fisherman, community activist, and a board member of Salmon for All. The first time I was in this building testifying on one of these allocation bills, and make no mistake, that's what this is. It had to do with and Representative Barnhart was on the panel at that day, and I'm sure he remembers it perfectly. It was a bill which would remove the word equitable from the directions to the fish and wildlife rules. That failed. It's pretty easy to defend equitable, and so that was my first blush. I've been back several times since then. I'm back again to oppose the Dash 3 amendment while we support the underlying bill in the Dash 1. As you've heard, this is not conservation. In fact, the commercial fishermen should be applauded for their developing a live capture fishery for the spring fishery. If we talk about sturgeon and other fish, ESA listed or not, the commercial fishery will stack up quite well against the sport fishery. I'm not arguing on either side of that. It will indeed destroy jobs, and there is no question about that. If somebody can show me that I'm being less than honest on it, I will quit coming down and testifying. It does remove access for the 94% of Oregonians who pay the bill for the hatcheries but do not sport fish for salmon. It gives them access to the world's greatest fish. It reduces the overall economic benefit of the resource to Oregon. Studies have shown that while both sports fishing and commercial fishing are valuable in allocation, it is always a split that returns the greatest value. Furthermore, it would create a loss for sport fishing. Sport fishing is not an efficient tool for harvesting large numbers of hatchery fish. To be successful, large returns are required, and still efficiency only occurs at the peak of the run. Now, during the dark days of the 90s, when our run numbers were abysmal, sport fishermen, tribal fisheries, conservation groups, and the commercial fishermen stood shoulder to shoulder on many issues to rebuild those runs, and they still do that outside of these particularly contentious issues. We will continue to work with that. But the numbers are coming back. In 2009, Washington and Oregon hatcheries had returning to their hatcheries. This is after commercial and sport fishery prosecutions. They had over 236,000 surplus coho that came back. They had 38,000 surplus fall chinook. They had 15,000 surplus spring chinook. We want the sports fishermen to have opportunities. They do have the summer fishery. They fish 6 days a week. No committee can give them seven days a week. We can't give them eight. The feds have clearly stated under hatchery reform that production will be cut if hatchery fish are not kept from spawning on the beds with the wild fish. Now, while I don't necessarily agree with their position on hatchery fish, nor do the tribes, the tool of commercial harvest is important for both sports and commercial. I know it's a great issue to raise membership and funds, but it's not a good issue for Oregon, and I urge that you do not adopt the -3 amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Holding.
Thank you. Can you tell me what the difference is, whether you catch fish in the main stem or in one of these safe areas? I mean, would you still catch the same amount of fish? And I'm just trying to see what the difference is of moving from, you know, the main stem of the channel off to one of these safe channels, I guess.
Chair Olson, Chair Hunt, Representative Holvey, there's a huge difference. The select areas were developed as a method of keeping us in business as we rebuilt those runs. They're relatively expensive to operate. There was an illusion that a lot more fish, 40% I believe was the number, were going to be put in them. If, in fact, we could somehow catch more fish and make more money in these very tiny select areas, year in, year out, I think there might be reason for us to sit down and talk with the sport fishing interests. The fish are somewhat different. There's a difference between the upriver spring chinook and the lower river fish. Not a great difference. They're both excellent fish. But the funding of this is very uncertain. Bonneville Power has sent a memo to Clatsop Economic Development which says that funding after this current funding cycle will likely end. This is something that the state is not able to take. The state of Washington talked about placing 2 million additional coho smolts down there. Maybe that's where the 40% comes from. But they haven't done it. They don't have money. There's no infrastructure. So this is it was a Band-Aid, and it's worked well and supported. But the idea that it can somehow replace this historic mainstem fishery, which is just now starting to be to come back as is sport fishing, is ludicrous. And in addition, as Kerry said, it will not support the numbers of fishermen. I feel it's a little bit presumptuous to say, well, maybe we'll just let you guys alternate days. We would not have the nerve to come in and suggest that the guides alternate days. We don't think that's right, and frankly, we don't think it's right for our fishery as well.
Representative Barr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a series of, if I could.
Please.
And one of them comes from the question that Representative Holvey just asked. You say that the BPA is ending its funding for these hatchery fish, if I understood that correctly. When do we expect that funding to end?
Somewhere in my file, I'm sorry, excuse me, Representative Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, Representative Barnhart.
You're fine.
Thank you. I do. I believe that's 2013, but please don't hold me to it. That's the major source of funding. There's some funding that comes from the state, but the big chunk comes from BPA, and that was referred in a memo that came to me from CDC about 3 weeks ago. It is not assured. It's just heads up. We don't want to spend money, do this, because the funding is uncertain going forward. And
so the answer is soon.
Soon, yes.
And if I could, one of you said, and I made a quick note, so I'm not sure, that if Oregon were to pass a rule like this, the dash threes, that Washington fishermen would continue to fish, and I think the suggestion, without actually being said, was that they might increase their catch. I don't know. Could you say a little more about that topic?
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, Representative Barnhart. The Columbia River is co-managed between Oregon and Washington, and Washington is not proposing any bill like this. So there's no division line right down the middle of the river. Oregon permit holders can fish on the Washington side of the river, and Washington permit holders can fish on the Oregon side of the river. And the Washington fishermen and the Washington permit holders would be able to continue fishing just as they have been.
And if I could, is it your view then that without the Oregon commercial fishermen working in the same waters that they would get some of the fish that otherwise you would have caught? I mean, that's the implication, I think, of what you said, but you didn't actually say it. So,
right, they would take our place, and I don't understand why we would do this to Oregon small businesses and Oregon working families at the benefit of Washington.
That would definitely happen, sir, because like I said, everything is impact driven. You have a certain amount of impacts to operate with, and you fish until those impacts are gone. And they would simply fish on our impacts and harvest our share of the fish.
Thank you. And I think this is my last question. Could somebody describe a little bit more what you mean when you say these impacts? For those of us who don't know much about fishing on the Columbia, there's sort of elementary level understanding of the rules and who makes decisions and how those decisions get made that I think would be very helpful as we look at this amendment.
Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, Representative Barnhart, it is a highly complex allocation issue. Impacts are a very polite way of saying dead ESA-listed fish. So the federal government determines how many fish will be allowed to be impacted, i.e. killed. And then the states, both the Oregon Commission and the Washington Commission, will take that number of impacts that are allotted to the non-tribal fishery. The tribes get first crack at 50% of the return, and they will take some of the impacts. And spring fish, I believe that's somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 to or more. In our case, 2% of the run can be impacted, of the listed run can be impacted. So the commissions work together.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Could I ask you to define listed?
ESA listed.
See, I really don't know this topic.
Okay. The runs, the fish in the Columbia River, and this is one of those cases where I had actually deferred to Jim Martin for that, could give you a textbook definition. But these are fish that have been listed under the Endangered Species Act. They are managed carefully. The take of any animal that's on the endangered list is highly regulated and is only allowed under a jeopardy ruling, which says that you will not jeopardize recovery if you impact X percent or X numbers of these listed endangered species. And so that drives the whole allocation. The simple way would be saying you get 60% of the fish, the public gets through commercial gets 40%, but it doesn't work like that. It all works through this impact mechanism. So when we talk about 60-40, which is what the commissions have agreed on, and they have to agree with each other to drive our joint fishery, then those fish, that number has ranged between 55-45 to 60-40 and variations on that. Since this fishery started back in the early 2000s, after runs began to build again. So then with those impact splits, you actually figure out how many fish you caught, and we're only, all of us are keeping hatchery fish. So in that case, when Jim says that the average has been 80% going to sports, 20% going to the public through commercial fishermen, that's how it all calculates out. I think it calls into question the fact that the complexity of these, that's the reason we have commissions, and they work carefully, and they work. So it has been a struggle coming to the coming back again and again to the legislature and trying to explain some of these things. First off, we have to learn them, and then we have to try and explain them. So thank you for your question.
And it turns out, Mr. Chair, I do have one more, if I could. These commissions you've described, do they have the authority to do what this bill, what this amendment would do? If they thought it was necessary in order to manage the fisheries?
Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, Representative Barnhart, of course they do. And they can they determine all of our seasons, they determine the impacts, they look at allocation, they're the ones who are charged with doing the allocation. They work with technical advisory teams, they work with the tribes on under USV Oregon, which determines how much is tribal, how much is non-tribal. I will just quickly say that your earlier issue of Washington fishermen, there's somewhat of an insult to injury that would come with this this bill, or maybe injury to injury. Just in the last few years, in order to get more support for select area funding from the Northwest Power Council, Oregon opened up our select areas, which are totally, that one which is totally in Oregon water in Young's Bay, to Washington permit holders. So if this were to go forward, not only would they have all the main stem, they would also be able to come into Young's Bay and fish in Oregon waters at the same time. I guess it could be undone, but at the same time, we are banned from those few fish we catch in the main stem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the chance to ask those questions.
Any chance you'd just defer to Jim Martin on all these issues?
Chair Hunt? No.
Okay. Just checking. Was it dry? One question. Obviously, there's a lot of, from my perspective, I mean, one of the major issues, because I think there are job impacts where you can argue. I mean, I think I've been a little concerned because the three of you, I think, have just presented one side of the job impacts. I think there are lots of job impacts on the other side of the argument. But the issues around kind of rates of mortality, and I've seen lots of different studies over a lot of different years that show different mortality rates, and probably mortality rates are getting better on all sides of sport fishing and commercial fishing. There's the one common denominator that seems to be true in all the studies is that commercial fishing has a higher rate of mortality than sport fishing when it comes to the native ESA-listed salmon and steelhead. In some studies, it's a lot higher. In some cases, it's some higher. The percentages are different, but it always seems like the mortality rates among these ESA-listed fish are higher with both gill netting and even the tangle nets. Anything that you have to say in response to that?
Not always that way, sir. It depends on what net you're looking at and what fishery you're looking at. Mm-hmm. Our tangle net currently has a release mortality association of 14.7%. Several hooking release mortalities, such as the ocean coho fishery and in buoy 10, 20% plus release mortality off of hooks is what those fisheries operate on. So those hooks do have a higher release mortality rate associated with them, and therefore a higher impact burn than the tangle net does.
And Representative Berger just asked for a definition of release mortality. Maybe you want to take that verse?
When you get into a selective fishery, what you have to be into in ESA, if you want to fish in an ESA fishery, you need to be some sort of a selective fishery to participate. We developed our tangle nets to be able to fish in the spring. You're to extract your hatchery fish out, your surplus fish. You are going to handle a certain amount of wild ESA-listed fish. Those need to be released back. We developed a tangle net and a recovery box to put the wild fish in, pump oxygen to them, that was all our own expense, resuscitate those fish, and release them in number one manner. That way they can, and that's a release mortality, is how many of those that you release back in are going to die. And there's an immediate release mortality And there's a long-term release mortality. There's a difference. And out of the boxes, it's almost a zero immediate release mortality. One of the problems with the guided sport fishery, we've asked them for years at the commission level to put recovery boxes on the guide boats, and a lot of the guide boats are as big as our gillnet boats are, 24, 26 feet. We've asked them to put a box on. The whole setup, the pump in the box, is about $1,000. And they resisted that. But with a sea lion problem like it is right now, a tired and played out fish that's put back into that water does not have much of a chance against a sea lion. It's going to get it like that. One that comes out of that recovery box, if Mr. Melcher is here, I'm not sure if he is or not, he could substantiate what I'm telling you. They hit the water out of that box fully revived and are gone like a bullet. And so the release mortality rate on that tangle net in that box is 14.7. And like I said, off some hooks in the fisheries is 20%. So it depends on what net you're looking at, how it's used, time and area, mesh size, and what sport fishery you're looking at.
Did you want to address that, Tubers?
I think we're addressing an issue that is that what you say is true. There is a lot. I'm sorry, Chair Hunt.
You're good.
Okay. That as we move forward on this, the issue of mortalities and release mortalities caused by various types of gear. First off, gear is not selective. If there's any argument to be made, determining how big your net is, that the opening will actually determine what kind of fish it will intercept. So in that case, it's selective. But certainly, nets generally and hooks generally by themselves do not determine what is caught. So it is what happens after they are caught. We use tangle net in the period that this -3 amendment talks about, and we're comparing between 10%, which is a number that came from a study done long ago on hooking mortality, sport fishing mortality. 10% of fish released will die. That actual study was closer to 15. The scientists determined that because water was colder, etc., that they would lower it. So it's an arbitrary number, but we're not arguing that. Our number is 12%. We had about 11.8. We had 2 more percent added on because of sea lion when you pulled in your net and there was a quarter of a fish. The question was, should we attribute it to the net or to the sea lion? And they gave us a sea lion add-on, which we don't do with the sport fishing. But these numbers are very, very close in the time frame that we're talking about. I think it's also important to realize that we're only fishing a few hours in the dates. And again, I'm a little bit confused. Mr. Stembridge, when he read the amendment, my amendment also says has an end date of July 31st.
Right.
And is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so we are dealing with that. So I'm sure I misheard it. And so anyway, looking at that, we assume that these numbers, these fish that are being released, we handle a few sturgeon and release them. The mortality of sturgeon from our nets, any size net, is roughly considered about 4%, which is about where it is with hook and line. Now, when you look at that, the number of undersized white sturgeon that are handled in our fishery compared to that of the sports fishery is minuscule. So I think we have to be a little bit careful about it. We go as we head down the roads of allocation, looking strictly at mortality, but it is a very complicated issue that the scientists and the managers look at in their decision making on a constant basis.
So I just have one more question, then I'll turn to Representative Wingard. So based on the numbers that you just outlined, if you accept the 10% mortality rate for sport fishermen, yours is 12.8 or 14.8, depending on how those extra counts. So am I understanding? I mean, it sounds like a small percentage difference, but really it's 28 to 48% more would be the mortality rate for commercial fishing. Am I understanding that right?
You are absolutely correct, Representative or Chair Hunt, and the fact is we have to look statistically what we do handle, how they are being handled, the arguments that are being made. But that doesn't drive the numbers by itself. Then we get into, forgive me, catch balancing. That is the decision making under U.S. v. Oregon, which determines how many fish non-tribal fishermen catch compared to the tribal fishermen. When tribes gave testimony under Senate Bill 736 at that hearing, they said that catch balancing under the 10-year U.S. v. Oregon agreement was based on commercial fishing and sport fishing as it's currently constructed. They are concerned that if, in fact, a bill like this or an amendment like this would go through, the catch balancing would go out of whack because of these different percentages, because of the lack of the ability to accurately monitor sport fishing impacts. And they might have to go back to court and redo that. What that means is that you don't get the full benefit of that amount that you would gain from gaining the impact. You only get up to the amount that's covered by the catch balancing between tribal and non-tribal. So it reduces the benefit dramatically to the, potentially would reduce the benefit dramatically to sport fishing at the same time eradicating this oldest continuing industry in the Pacific Northwest.
Representative Weir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's great to be back on the Ag and Natural Resources Committee. I was on the Ag Committee last time. Just for a little broader perspective, it's been a few years since I have delved into the ESA salmon issue, but I seem to recall that we had an issue with some birds out on the mouth of the Columbia eating quite a few of these endangered species fish. And I'm also aware that we have some large fishing fleets. They not all carry American flags on them that pursue these endangered species outside the mouth of the Columbia. So I was just hoping you could give a little perspective of what kind of impact those predations have on this salmon population that we spend so much money trying to recover and enhance and increase versus what both the commercial and the sport fishermen are doing in this area of the Columbia.
Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, Representative Wingard, our impacts on ESA, the combined impacts of sport fishermen and our commercial fishing fleet are a minor impact compared to those of cormorants, Caspian terns, California sea lions, seals, stellar sea lions. I served on the federal task force, one of the 18 members regarding California sea lions. We voted 17-1. I was on the whack 'em and stack 'em side. The numbers at the mouth, observed numbers by California sea lions only at the mouth, what can be observed from the Bonneville Dam is considered to be 4% of this spring Chinook run, twice our combined impacts of the people in this room. That doesn't count the 1,000 to 1,500, that's the 80 or so or 90 that happen to be at the dam, not the 1,000 or 100 that are in the river. Doing a mass balance at the first six-day meeting 3 years ago, they would not speculate on what the entire impact would be. They actually were able to do that at the second go-around this last year. And it can be as high as 20% sea lions alone. Many fish have what are called pit tags, small wire tags in their heads. The birds are focusing on the small fish going out to sea. If you go to Sand Island or Rice Island at the river and wave a detecting wand over the sand, I think there was concern of hearing loss with the people doing those surveys because of just the millions of these pit tags that are showing up there. Do we have issues? Yes. Well, I should say that it was sport fishermen, tribal fishermen, commercial fishermen, again, standing side by side on the task force and on other issues that address these much bigger issues than the allocation. And it saddens me to be here to fight for our jobs when we could be... I could have spent the day at the tribal conference working on some of the issues that you bring up.
So we've got... I want to thank all three of you for being here, and would invite forward next panel. I think we have three legislators in the room: Representative Boone, Representative Witt, Representative Kennemer. Is there another legislator? Yeah, why don't all three of you come forward, and if you'd like to. If you don't want to testify, that's fine too. I just give you, since all three of you are here, give you a chance to testify. Representative Boone or Representative Witt, would you want to testify? No? Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Kennemer, State Representative, Oregon City, Canby. Oregon City, some of the finest fishing on the Willamette River, sports fishing. I thank you for the opportunity to talk. Couple of things I would like to suggest. I have a couple of comments that I would like to make, and then I would think you might want to consider having a little bit of rebuttal from either Mr. Irwin or Mr. Martin. I think that the vast majority of the gillnet fishery on the Columbia is in Oregon waters, and as I understand the bill, it would prohibit all gillnetting, whether that was Washingtonians or Oregonians, in those zones. I think there are some other issues about recovery and how infrequently that is used that might mitigate that. But my comments, a couple of things. I guess I'd like to make four comments and then share four comments from a few years ago. One is, I think this bill is about growing jobs, and increasing sports fishing dramatically does that. Number two, there are endangered species, more than there were 20 years ago, and we addressed this, and we need even more protection. And this time we have a viable alternative with these safe zones that provides good gillnet catch without incidental kill and without losing jobs. And fourthly, we have the opportunity and obligation to resolve this decades-old problem, and I would note other rivers in Oregon do not have gillnets. Harkening back, if I could, just a moment, to Senate Bill 611. On March 8th, 1991, I had 4 points at that hearing. It's vital to preserve the wild fish. This bill is proposed to stop the incidental fish kill due to gill netting. It's not an assault on the gill net industry. The issue is the management of the resource. And the gut of the issue is selective harvest. I think 20 years later, it's time to take the next step. And I would encourage you to do that. I thank you for the courage to bring this up and talk about it. And being a superstitious sports angler myself, I brought my salmon tie that I wore in those days and that I brought to the hearing back on March 8th of 91, and I brought it for good luck today. Thank you.
The style was a little thinner back then, wasn't it?
You know, styles were different, and Sherry recommended I not wear it today.
Thank you. Representative Boone, welcome.
Yes, and I used my prerogative as a woman to change my mind. So, for the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, and Mr. Co-Chair, and members of the committee, thank you for asking me up. I do support the bill. We need this bill because the state can't stand to be sued for another $2 million. I think you've heard about the bill, what that does. It makes right what we have an agreement with the out-of-state commercial fishing fleet to change the cost that we do a little bit up higher than what we charge. Then they won't sue us. I think that's what we need. I just found out about this amendment yesterday from a lobbyist, and so I had to do a lot of catch-up work on that. I don't agree with this amendment. Just last weekend I was in Astoria kicking off the celebration for the bicentennial, and in at least two exhibits, one in the Maritime Museum and one in some of the other areas, are celebrating the history of Astoria, which includes the gillnet fishery. And it's a big deal up there. People come down there, they see it, they want to watch, they'd love to see people when they are out there fishing, but they were right, you have to catch it. It's an hourly season, not a daily, weekly, monthly season. It's by the hour. And they usually fish at night. And I might be wrong, but I've seen them out there because it's 6 hours. It's from midnight to seven or whatever. So, and one other thing I'd like to point out is the importance of the Columbia River Spring Chinook. If we eliminate this from our ability as non-fishing people, I do fish, but I have a hard time on the river. I get seasick. I know it's a river. I get river sick then. But I would like to be able to continue to buy this fish, which is excellent, very healthy fish. I know that the very best ones sometimes go to the big restaurants in New York and other places for other people to enjoy. But we will not be able to have that fish again. We will be eating hatchery fish, and I don't want to get into that discussion. But the spring Chinook that we get from our fishermen, our commercial fishing fleet, are the best you can buy. I mean, you can eat them raw. The other piece I wanted to say, and Representative Hunt, we did pass a resolution for you to help us deal with the seals, because my husband has a boat and I have to hear about every fish he's lost to the seals. So with that, I will stop. I would take any questions, but the real important thing here today is this bill, getting this bill passed so that the state doesn't incur a huge lawsuit when we do have within our hands and our ability to have an agreement, and they don't have to, but the commercial fleet, out-of-state fleet, has agreed to this. So I would ask you not to adopt this amendment and just pass the bill. Thank you.
Questions for Representative Kenner or Representative Boone? Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Hunt. And just not to be confrontational, but the Umpqua River has some pretty good taste in fish in it also.
I would probably fish that one. I could probably manage that.
Unfortunately, a little bass.
Yeah. And it has no gillnets.
And no sea lions.
That's not entirely true. I've seen them up at Scotland.
We take care of them a little differently than
they all do. Representative Krieger got in trouble about that, so don't go too far, Representative Freeman. Any other questions for these two? I had the member of the committee. Thank you both for coming down.
Thank you.
Kurt, would you mind? We had a committee member too who wanted to ask you a question. You may have something. I don't know if you have anything you want to say off the bat, or we can just go to questions.
Less than 2 months.
That will be your choice, Kurt. If you want to say something to begin, or if you just want to entertain questions, your call.
Yeah, they're gorgeous, aren't they?
Yeah. You introduce yourself for the record, please.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee for record. My name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. No, I really did not come here prepared to testify other than give my earlier testimony on the original House Bill 3657 and our interest in that bill, as well as the Dash 1 amendments, which clarify the effective date. Happy to answer any questions. I did not bring all of my background facts on predator impacts on salmonids in the Columbia Basin. I have a pretty good idea. I could talk off the cuff on that a little bit if you'd like, but I'm here at your pleasure.
Okay. Representative Holby.
Thank you. Unfortunately, my first question was about what percentage of the fish that the sea lions eat are in these special zones as opposed to the main stem. So since you can't answer that, probably I'll move on to a more serious one. And I guess that is, I'm hearing, you know, the issue between the Washington and Oregon. So the management of this river, if this amendment were to pass, how does that impact with the ability of us to enforce this main stem from the Washington commercial fishermen?
Sure. Co-Chair Hunt, Representative Holby. So while we manage the Columbia River right now concurrently with Washington, we actually have a compact that was ratified by the United States Congress that allows us to work with Washington to manage the fisheries in unison, if you will. And that compact is required under the U.S. Constitution. The states can't act, anyway, I'm not a constitutional law expert on that. But anyway, states have a compact that ratifies and authorizes us to do that. However, there is still a state line. And so the state line is defined. There is a state line. It goes essentially down the middle of the ship channel. It is true in the Astoria area. It takes a large deviation and follows much more closely to the Washington shoreline than to the Oregon shoreline, because that's where the old ship channel used to be. But nonetheless, there is still a state line. And I certainly am not here to speak for the state of Washington. I think from our perspective, the state of Oregon, if Washington did something unilaterally, I expect that you all and others would expect us to continue to implement whatever your direction was on the Oregon side of the river. So I would expect that they would in some form do that on their side of the river, as it is defined, the state line.
Follow up. I'm not sure I got the answer that I was looking for. A little more clarity. Would in fact, if this -3 amendment pass, would ODF and W enforce the provisions of this on the Washington fishermen if they were on the Oregon side of the river?
Coach Hunt, Representative Holley, I misunderstood your question. Certainly, if we in Oregon adopt a law that is in place, our commission and the agency and the state police are going to enforce those laws, at least on the Oregon side of the river. So we would, in a sense, close the Oregon side of the Columbia River, the formally defined piece of the river that is in Oregon state territory, to commercial fishing. And if a Washington fisherman was fishing on the Oregon side of the line, they would be subject to enforcement action. We would not be able to take any enforcement action if they're fishing on the Washington side of the line. And, of course, the fish don't necessarily stay on one side or the other.
Neither do the birds.
And so can you tell me just generally, does the area that this bill talks about, the main stem fishing, how is that positioned in relationship to that state line? In other words, would this bill keep the Washington fishermen out of that main stem area?
Co-Chair Hunt, Representative Holby, it would keep them out of that main stem area, but only so far as the Oregon portion of the main stem. The Washington side would still be open for the Washington fishermen.
So I guess, Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess that was my question. Is the boundary line in the middle of the main stem, or is it on one side or the other, or does it change going up and down the river?
Co-Chair Hunt, Representative Holby, it is, and this is a general description, it is essentially in the middle of the ship channel. So in some areas of the river, the ship channel may be on the Oregon side, in other areas of the river, it may be roughly in the center of the river, in other areas it may be on the Washington side of the river. So it is technically right in the middle of the ship channel, with one exception. Well, there's a couple of exceptions, but one exception, a major exception, being in the Astoria area. The old ship channel was much closer to the Washington side of the river than the current modern ship channel. The state line, however, follows the old historic ship channel, which is much closer to the Washington state line than the current modern ship channel. And, of course, as you approach any of the Columbia River dams, the ship channel will deviate over to the lock for passage at the dam. Of course, the state line does not deviate over into the locks. It takes the old historic ship channel.
And one more.
Last one.
Thank you. So if this -3 amendment were to pass, is it your estimation that it would change the catch to the commercial fishermen, granted that they would be in a fishing in the safe zones, I guess, and would it change the escapement of the required escapement for the river or fish going upstream?
Co-Chair Hunt, Representative Holby, I think, let me take that in, I guess, in parts. So will it affect the main stem commercial harvest? And I'm going to, I guess, maybe not give you an easy yes or no answer. It depends on what Washington does. If Washington continues to fish on their side of the river, they could conceivably catch all those commercial fish that would have, some of which would have otherwise been caught by Oregon fishermen. And certainly the select area harvest is, we're essentially at full utilization. These areas are essentially terminal areas where all the fish that return to them get harvested. So if you increase, under current strategies, release strategies in those areas, if you increase the fishing effort in those areas, the associated catch does not increase. In order to increase the catch in those areas, you would actually have to increase the production. So then, the second part of your question was relating to, refresh my memory.
The escapement of fish going up the river.
Oh, escapement of fish. So I think the underlying premise here is that, and you heard some of the earlier testimony was referring to impacts. All of our fisheries are managed based on their impacts on listed fish, ESA listed fish. The underlying premise in all this is that if you eliminate the commercial fishery in the main stem, and let's just say Washington, just for the sake of it, let's just say Washington agreed to eliminate the commercial fishery in the main stem, and I don't know that they necessarily would, but let's say that they did. The premise here is that then those impacts on ESA listed fish would be transferred to the recreational fishery to allow for more recreational fishing opportunity, which essentially then leads to the same. You ultimately, in the end, you have the same impact on the ESA listed fish. You don't change, you don't increase any escapement. If this bill were, for instance, saying that any savings from this were passed on to escapement, then one could argue that it does increase the escapement of wild fish.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Kurt, for coming up. Appreciate
that. Yep.
I realize you were on the spot and not planning to come forward.
My pleasure.
I would close the public hearing on House Bill 3657. There are not the votes to pass the dash threes or the bill as is, so we will come back to it. Open a work session on House Bill 3668.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3668, you heard on the 26th of May, it requires the Commissioner of Labor to notify Director of Veterans Affairs when information or complaint is filed regarding alleged violation of employment rights of militia members or discrimination against members of the uniformed military if that contact is authorized by the member.
Colleagues, we heard this. I don't think we have anyone to bring us any new information on this. Co-Chair Olson will run a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3668 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Olson moves House Bill 3668 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, Amy, please call the roll.
Representative
Wingert? Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Yes.
Excused.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt?
Aye. Motion carries. And that will ask Representative Matthews to carry that bill on the floor. Close the work session on House Bill 3668 and open a public hearing on HCR 41. Chamber.
This is HCR 41. It memorializes philanthropist Harold J. Schnitzer.
And we have signed up to testify Paul Romaine and John DiLorenzo. There is a seat in the middle that you can utilize at your discretion to separate the two of you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine, an attorney in Portland, and I'm here actually not representing anybody that I normally represent. I'm representing the Schnitzer, Levin, and Goodman families. I have to be related to the families. My wife is Harold's niece, so I have a very close relationship, and I'm going to commend to you the Dash 1 amendments. you have before you, which basically corrects the mistake that was in the Oregonian and in the resolution, that basically Harold was the sixth of seven children that lived to adulthood. I know that because my father-in-law was the seventh, the youngest. They were about a year and a half apart. It's more difficult to testify when you're talking about family. Excuse me. Actually, I thought after sitting through the fish stuff, I wouldn't be emotional. And please don't hold this against me on any of my other stuff out there, because I'm usually a real tough SOB. But it's basically tougher to talk about family than it is to talk about other things you're paid to talk about. There is a concept in Jewish rabbinic thought that's called tikkun olam. It basically means repair the world. And it's a concept that Harold epitomized. He was a person who really lived the life that everybody should want to live. His father came to this country from Russia, escaped from the Russian army, basically was conscripted. Very little guy. My wife is very much like him. He came over here with absolutely nothing. He actually went to Astoria. Thank you. Went to Astoria. He started basically walking door to door collecting scrap. Didn't have any government assistance. Had some relatives that he knew that kind of helped him out. He got enough to buy a cart, or have a cart, so he had to use the cart. And then he met a man by the name of Wolf, and Wolf had a horse. And they formed a company called Schnitzer Wolf, which you now know today as Schnitzer Steel, which is a publicly traded company, which is one of the largest, if not the largest, scrap company in the world. It started basically going door to door in Astoria. He had seven kids who lived to adult. He actually had them with a woman by the name of Rose, who was not the woman he actually sent for. He was the woman who was supposed to be his wife in Russia. When he got here and made a little money, he sent for her. She didn't have the cell phone, so you had no idea what was going on. And so they sent Rose's, the sister, that was Rose. And Sam and Rose had nine kids, seven of whom lived to adulthood. Harold did a lot of things. A lot of them are in the resolution that John actually crafted beautifully. And John has done a lot of work for the companies, for actually Harold's company. Harold left the company, the Schnitzer Steel Company, in the early 50s and set out on his own in real estate. But the family was always very, very close. Harold did a couple of things that aren't in the resolution. I just want to mention two of them real quick, and I'll get out of your hair because I know it's been a long day for you. One of them is he and Arlene started Fountain Gallery, which was really the birthplace for Northwest art. It was Arlene who really had the idea to get Northwest artists known. She started this gallery, and she would have people in, and Jordan tells the story where these folks, they'd have an exhibit, and after a few days, nothing was selling, and then all of a sudden, he'd come back and he'd find a red tag or two on a couple of the pieces. And what would happen was Harold would feel guilty that nothing was selling, so he went around and bought things without letting anybody know, which was classic Harold. Which leads me to the sort of final thing I wanted to mention. I know John was going to allude to it too. For those of you who weren't around in 99 when John and I actually worked together on a piece for Harold, there's a story that I don't know if you have heard, but in 93 when the federal building was blown up in Oklahoma City, there was also an apartment building across the street from the federal building that was destroyed too. That was Harold's building. And Harold basically moved everybody out of that apartment at his expense, put them up in housing separate at his expense, rebuilt the building at his expense, and moved them back in. He never told anybody about that, at least outside of his immediate family. I found out because a fellow who represents the Oklahoma beer distributors happened to see some articles and sent me an email saying, aren't you related to this guy? And that's how I found out, so I inquired. That's what Harold was all about. Like I said in the beginning, Tikkun Olam is basic repairing the world, and that's what Harold was all about. Every penny he made that's remaining goes into basically repairing the world. It goes into charity. That's what the state would not be anything like it is today in the arts, in the idea in medicine, in all types of areas, if it wasn't for Harold Schmitzer. And I commend this resolution to you.
John. Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner at the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and it is a pleasure for me to appear today with my longtime friend and colleague, Paul Romaine, to honor Harold Schmitzer and to support HCR 41 and the -1 amendments. I represented Harold Schmitzer as a lawyer and a legislative advocate since 1998 on a whole variety of projects. Three of the most colorful were one that I worked on with Paul in 1989, House Bill 2636, which following a formal mediation process initiated by Governor Kitzhaber led to a compromise which survives to this day, which structures the relationship between local governments, owners, and tenants of Section 8 housing. In 2001, Harold was an industry leader, advocated House Bill 2206, which equalized the tax treatment between out-of-state residents and in-state residents when they exchanged real estate for other real estate. And most recently, Senate Bill 787, which you have just adopted and sent on to the governor, will provide reimbursement by insurers for telemedical services provided to patients who suffer from diabetes, and will initiate a pilot project at the Harold Schmitzer Diabetes Health Center at OHSU, which we hope will be a precursor for the efficient delivery of healthcare services in the future by telemedicine. On these and many other assignments, I had the privilege of working quite closely with Harold, who became a real inspiration to me. We spoke a great deal over the years about real estate and about business, about his views on how to encourage enterprise, how to accumulate wealth, and what to do with it once the wealth was accumulated. Harold told me that he had structured his working career in thirds. He said the first third was spent identifying opportunities and establishing oneself. The second third was amassing wealth and value. And the third third was giving it all away. That was Harold's credo. Those of you who have spent time in the Bay Area are likely familiar with Harold's efforts to restore the historic Claremont Hotel in Berkeley. The Claremont, which was one of his flagship acquisitions, was a source of great pride to him. But true to his formula, when he sold it in 1998, he devoted all of the proceeds, which approximated $100 million off of the sale in 1998, to fund his family charitable foundations. All of it he gave to his charitable foundations. He was a real estate mogul who treated every person with the utmost courtesy and respect. He had many commercial tenants. He was, though, among his tenants' best customers, knowing that their successes equated to his success. He knew that his residential tenants were not just renting spaces to sleep and cook, they were renting their homes. One instance in particular, which Paul mentioned, made this very clear. And as Paul indicated, Harold owned a piece of property right next door to the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building, which was bombed by Timothy McVeigh on April 21st.
And John, if you could summarize, we have two more bills we're trying to take up today.
Okay, well, I will then conclude with one statement, and that is a year after Harold did the thing he did, Jeff Manning wrote an article in The Oregonian, and I will just quote a paragraph from that. He said, "Ginger London and Brian Brown know they are among the lucky ones. They are still alive. But the Oklahoma City apartment building, the 275-unit Regency Tower, was heavily damaged in the April 19th explosion that destroyed the nearby building.
With structured tower, residents were given just minutes to leave. Some found themselves on the street in their slippers. But a Portland real estate mogul has made life a little less chaotic for the tower's 350 dispossessed residents. Harold Schnitzer's Portland-based Harsh Investment Corporation owns the tower. At Schnitzer's direction, employees arranged to house all of the residents in two motels. Harsh paid for the rooms and even gave each resident meal money each day. Schnitzer said his company paid $6,000 a day to house and feed the tenants until Oklahoma City was declared a disaster area and the federal government picked up the tab. And here's the quote from Harold. Quote, "You've got to take care of people," said Schnitzer, whose company owns hundreds of millions of dollars worth of real estate in the United States. Quote, "They had no place to go, no clothes, nothing. Good Lord, what were they going to do?" Co-chairs and members, it's things like this that gauge, in my view, the measure of a person. Harold Schnitzer was a very, very special person and a real inspiration to me and should be to all of us. I heartily endorse and commend this resolution and ask that you send it to the floor with your recommendation that it be adopted.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Thank you both for coming forward.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on HCR 41 and open a work session on HCR 41.
Mr. Chair.
Co-chair Olson.
Move the dash 1 amendments into HCR 41.
Co-chair Olson moves the dash 1 amendments to HCR 41. Discussion?
So much, Mr. Chair.
Did you have discussion on the dash 1 amendments?
No.
Any objection? So we're Co-chair Olson.
Mr. Chair, move that HCR 41 as amended to the House floor with a do adopt recommendation.
Co-chair Olson moves HCR 41 as amended to the floor with a do adopt.
I want to dispel today the myth of the hard-boiled lobbyists and recognize that this is really a great Oregonian, and I'm honored to support this memorial.
Great. Any further discussion? Representative Wayne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just say that people like Mr. Schnitzer are critical in our society. They do an extraordinary job of building wealth and then turning around and using that wealth to do things that perhaps no one else would do, and oftentimes leave behind institutions that impact lives for dozens, perhaps hundreds of years after their passing. It is sad that the state has lost such a person, and I hope that we have many others to take his place in the future. You can never have too many of these types of people as citizens of your state. Thank you.
Amy, please call the roll.
Representative
Berger.
Aye.
Excused.
Representative Garrett?
Excused.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Co-chair Olson?
Aye.
Co-chair
Hunt? Aye. Motion carries, and we'll ask the bill, the resolution sponsors, Representatives Brewer and Greenlick, to co-carry. Close the work session on HCR 41, and let's actually jump down to the last one on the agenda, open a public hearing on House Bill 3681. Victoria, please lead us in. Actually, let me go ahead and invite Dana Hepper, Beth Cook, Colleen Moss. We've got a total of six folks to testify on this bill. Begin. Is Dana still here?
Yes, here.
So Beth and Colleen, come on forward. So we've got a total of five to testify on this bill. Go ahead, Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3681 allows students to attend schools in districts of which they are not legal residents with the written consent of the district in which the school is located.
Welcome to the Rules Committee. You can go in either order you'd like. Would you prefer her to go first? Okay.
Thank you.
If it's possible, if this panel could take a total of no more than 5 minutes. We'll give a total of no more than 5 minutes to the next panel, and then we're going to try and be out here by 5:15.
We will do our best. Chair Hunt and Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Beth Cook, and I'm a resident of Yamhill County. I'm here today as a concerned parent in support of House Bill 3681. You all have a copy of fairly lengthy written testimony and a packet of information regarding this measure, so I'll go ahead and just speak from the heart on this. This is actually a duplicate bill that was of something that I introduced or had introduced in the Senate earlier this session based on my own experience with my son Josh. Josh was born with several sensory issues, tactile sensitivity, you know, they assign all these labels that parents know nothing about when they first have a child. Just to put it easily, he was the 18-month-old in the Mommy Me music class in the corner with his hands over his ears rocking himself in the corner. Due to outstanding health insurance, you know, a great pediatrician, access to wonderful occupational therapy, preschool teachers at Linfield College, we were able to access resources with the goal that we would get him ready for a traditional classroom setting. Still, as he got close to his kindergarten year, it was, you know, recommended by his occupational therapist in particular that we seek out a smaller school setting. Well, there were no smaller schools within our district. In fact, there had been when we moved there. We moved into a smaller school, but it had been expanded the year prior, and I had voted to do so as part of the Planning Commission because that was what was best for the system. So we looked outside our current district, and there were several different available options on our commute route. I spoke to those schools, kind of researched, you know, how this might work, and then contacted the district in spring of Josh's last preschool year. And was told that, well, you got to call back the first week of August because that's the soonest they would be considering interdistrict transfers. So when I contacted them, I was met with serious resistance. Was kind of surprised at that. In fact, you know, given the fact that we kind of had, I had really good conversations with the pediatrician who thought, oh, no, this won't be any problem getting this approved. But what I found was that it's a district-by-district case. Some districts, it's really easy to find these things, you know, get these needs met. In others, it's not. In my particular district, you know, I hit a brick wall. So after several conversations, you know, and I'd asked, well, what is this all about? Why this opposition? And they said, well, it all comes down to money. Well, and for a parent who'd been dealing with these issues for about five years by that point, you know, I had to ask that other question, well, what about Josh? And I was told, well, we're sure he'll survive. That was not my goal for Josh. I wanted him to be in a situation where he would thrive and not just survive his educational experience. And so I did not have the bandwidth at that point to be up for a big battle. We had mere weeks before school started. I was getting ready to go back to work off maternity leave. And so I went ahead and enrolled him in private school. Paid the checks. But that kept me up at night because that option would not have been available to everyone out there, and there were several different public school options within our system available to us. So the second year I went back and was met with similar opposition from the district, and by that point I talked to so many different parents from throughout the state, found out that this is not just about one district, one child, you know, or one family. This is a very common experience throughout our state, and it's something that we don't have a lot of equity around. Again, some districts handle this great, some districts don't. And so I contacted my state senator, and with Senator Boquist and Representative Betty Comp, put together a draft of a bill to present and worked with various stakeholders, got input, you know, met with as many different types of people as I possibly could to gain input, and so that was the effort that I've been working on for the last several months. I do believe that we need to correct the situation. House Bill 3681 is a wonderful opportunity for us to utilize our existing system in a much more effective manner. You're going to hear, you know, the sky is going to fall if we do this. The fact is, you know, we hear a lot of bad and negative things about the school system. I don't think we hear enough positive things about what we have to offer within our education system here in Oregon, and I would love to see us use it as effectively and as efficiently as possible. This is an opportunity to use existing resources with no additional state funding. It also clears up an existing issue regarding special education students by kind of correcting some of the funding issues that are around them. So I hope that you'll support House Bill 3681. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Colleen Moss, and I'm a longtime resident of Lake Oswego and went through kindergarten through 12th in Lake Oswego schools, and wanted to come and share my experience of my daughter because her struggle and feeling trapped in the Lake Oswego schools was extremely difficult, and I just want to see if there's a way to give other kids who are also suffering an option. Basically, so many kids are currently administratively barred from getting a transfer because superintendents don't want to lose the state funds. And so what happens is even kids with health issues are not allowed to transfer. And my daughter, our family, was one of those families. Our 13-year-old daughter in fifth grade started suffering from large amounts of stress related to school performance and testing and grades. And she's a very sensitive, talented, and gifted child. And she just started being completely overwhelmed. And we went through a year of trying to seek advice from professionals to try to reduce her stress level. Nothing was working. We were trying natural methods, and my daughter was really suffering. So we went to the superintendent and asked for a transfer. And the neighboring school district was happy to take Haley, but the superintendent would not approve the transfer. So my daughter went through two more years of suffering, continued stress. Every summer it would be completely fine. When she started school again, she was in amazing amounts of stress. And by the end of her seventh grade, she just could no longer fall asleep. I mean, it was, and I knew we couldn't do anything more. I had to find a change for my daughter. And private schools were too expensive. My daughter really wanted a public school environment, a normal, quote, normal environment in her mind. And so we decided that we'd pay public school tuition in another district. And I'm really happy to report that 9 months later, my daughter is completely happy again. She's thriving in school. The change in the district was tremendously different for my daughter. The messaging from the other district was much more calm and accepting, and they even use different words. Instead of tests, they say learning targets. And for my daughter, it worked so much better, and it was the right fit for her. Now, I know Lake Oswego schools are great schools, and most people are completely happy, but my daughter really needed a change, and the only way that I could accomplish that for her is to pay a second public school tuition. So it's, for me, it's possible. It's really difficult for our family. Of course, we're trying to save for college. And I'm borrowing funds from a family member in order to pay her eighth grade school tuition. But for other kids that are poor, they don't have those options. And I just feel like it's really, really important for inter-district transfers to really be possible so kids don't suffer. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Any questions for these two? Appreciate you coming forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So I invite forward Tony Vicknair, Lori Wimmer, Morgan Allen, and we'll talk about 8 minutes, so we'll give you about 8 minutes. We'll be done soon thereafter. Welcome to the Rules Committee. Proceed in whatever order you prefer. Tony, you're up.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee, I'd say good afternoon, but I wrote that earlier. It's good evening now. For the record, my name is Tony Vicknair. I'm the Director of Secondary Programs for McMinnville School District. I'm also the Mid-Willamette Education Consortium Chair, so I represent all the high schools in the three-county area, Yamhill, Polk, and Marion County. And I'm responsible for the district's inter-district transfer process. I've passed out to you the testimony that our superintendent did in March, and which has some data around our inter-district transfer numbers and how we work together with our neighboring communities. It's my understanding the committee is considering changing the laws relative to approval between districts for students attending school outside their resident district. I'm also aware this proposal, as you've heard, was initially brought forward by a resident of our district who never has actually had a child attend our school system. As our superintendent testified in March to the House Education Committee, we have a long history of approval for placements between districts. In fact, we have approved at least 45 to a neighboring district alone. That's share our boundary. You have a copy of that testimony. Choice for parents about the schools their children attend is important. That's why we have public and private. That's why we have charters and we have homeschool. We even have choice within our own school district between high schools, elementary schools, and middle schools. Within the high school, we choose career pathways. We choose health occupations, criminal justice, culinary arts, engineering, and much more. The current approval process between districts provides for choice, and we have records with us, as you can see, for just how well that exists between our district and other school districts within Yamhill County. Choice does exist. You should vote no on this bill, not because you don't support choice for parents, but because it will result in many unintended negative outcomes. It does not address the residency rules for athletes changing teams outside the parameters of OSAA, nor does it do anything to prevent recruitment efforts to create the haves and have-not environments within the public system. Because funding follows the students, as has been stated, it really sets up systems to lose revenue without the ability to respond, with staffing reductions adding further turmoil to schools at the same time school systems are making drastic cuts because of the state shortfall. I mentioned earlier I'm the chair of the Mid-Willamette Education Consortium, and so I work hand-in-hand with all the high schools around the Tri-County area to provide opportunities for students. We articulate the needs between schools and regions and make sure all kids have excellent opportunities to advance beyond high school. This can be done in a planful way and would be disruptive if schools from year to year never know who they might serve, let alone how they might staff or fund a program. I urge on behalf of myself, our superintendent, the school district, and COSA to vote no on this. I am happy to address any questions you have. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll wait. Yeah. Either Morgan or Lori, whatever you prefer.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen here on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. I've submitted written testimony, so I'll just try to summarize very briefly. Our primary objection to this bill is the erosion of local control for our locally elected school boards and superintendents. Right now, there is an interdistrict transfer process in Oregon. Each impacted school district, so both the district where the student lives and the district where a student may wish to attend, have equal say over transfers, and House Bill 3681 eliminates that balance and allows school districts to enroll non-resident students without consideration for the resident district, essentially creating open enrollment in our K-12 system in Oregon. And that's our primary objection. I've listed a few other concerns we have. I'll just mention them briefly. The first is equity and opportunity. If you look at other states or districts that have open enrollment policies, there's a lottery or application process where every student, whether they're special ed, ELL, behavior problems, all have equal access to the available slots. And this bill has a pretty weak and undefined mechanism to ensure opportunity for all students. The second policy question we would raise is, under this bill, it would allow school districts to enroll students from neighboring districts without the say of the resident district. And literally, the state would pay for the transportation costs for districts to roll buses into neighboring districts, pick up the students, transfer them back to their students, and the state would pick up the cost under the current state school funding formula. So that's a great concern for us. That would greatly increase transportation costs at a time when we're looking for ways to cut expenses in our school districts. Another concern for us is there's really no criteria, associated with it. There seems to be any reason, it's a discussion worth having. Shouldn't students be allowed to transfer because it's convenient for the parent, because of their being bullied or harassed, because of academic opportunities? What about the extracurricular activities, sports, and other competitive things? All those questions are left unanswered by the House Bill 3681. And the last thing that we'd hope you consider is, our school board members are worried about providing a comprehensive education to their students, and this is especially true in smaller declining enrollment rural districts. Even the loss of just a few students can greatly impact the educational opportunities for the students that are left in those districts. And this bill places no limits or prohibitions on school districts marketing, trying to entice families to come to their districts, spruce up their facilities, and try to steal kids from neighboring districts. So, we hope you would at least consider that as a concern. So at a time, when the Oregonian newspaper is reporting that we're well below the national K-12 funding, and this is the fifth straight biennium when K-12 funding has received a declining share of the state general fund and lottery dollars, we'd urge you not to decrease local control and add further unpredictability to school district funding by opposing this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank
Thank you. Lori, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, both co-chairs and committee members, for your record. Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association, and its 45,000 members, also here to oppose House Bill 3681. I would like to make five very quick comments for your record. We are in agreement with the two prior testifiers. There have been two prior bills in this session on this subject in both education policy committees. This issue has been addressed and considered, and both of those policy committees in each chamber have elected not to pass those bills. And so we'd like you to keep that in mind in addition to all the fine points that were made previously. Additionally, we provide many options and choices, as you've heard from my colleagues, whether it be charter schools, the ability to transfer based on NCLB regulations, assessment-based transfers, special education placements, alternative education placements, magnets, in-district programs that are choice programs, expanded options and other dual enrollment programs, and so on. At some point, the issues of choice need to be balanced against the issues of financial and fiscal prudence. And when we have a budget that is $1 billion shorter than what we need for the coming biennium, it would seem to me an inappropriate time for us to disrupt that balance by adding another little grenade into the mix, as this bill could easily do. We think that it would just exacerbate the financial challenges of districts that are to come. Also, I'd like to point out there's an emergency clause on this bill, and that is a July 1st emergency clause. Less than a month from now, it would go into effect were you to move this bill. These budgets for school districts are already in the finalization phase based on the $5.7 billion appropriation. We don't have time to reconnoiter and recalculate based on any kind of disruptions. As you've heard, declining enrollment is another exacerbator of financial instability, and we have two-thirds of our districts in a declining enrollment situation. So even a few students could make a huge difference with respect to hiring and firing and even capacity issues on the structural side. So we respectfully ask you leave this bill on the table because it elevates the option of a few at the expense of the many. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, two real quick questions, Mr. Chair. Tony, apparently there were two prior bills. Who were the sponsors? For Lori, maybe you can tell me.
Sure. Co-chairs, House Bill 3550 was sponsored by Representative Parrish, and Senate Bill 745 was sponsored by Senator Boquist, Representative Kopp, and Representative Conger.
Okay, thank you. And then one additional question. I get what you're trying to describe here, and Morgan, I understand too what you're saying. I mean, you're talking about stealing kids or cherry-picking too, the potential exists. But what do you do when you actually have a child that, I mean, you have one school district that says no, but there's no remedy to resolve a situation mainly because it might be a personality issue, and it's not sports, and it's not academics. It's time they have to move. What do you do?
Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, I'd like to answer that by our own practice at McMinnville, and I hope that that's something that is practiced around. As a previous administrator in Salem Kaiser School District, at the high school level, we had opportunity to work with families quite often in this transfer process. As you can see from the data that I presented, we do look at our students and their needs pretty clearly and pretty openly as more than 2-to-1 rent transfer out of McMinnville, in which we have a wonderful program, to schools for a variety of reasons, as well as health reasons and safety reasons and educational program reasons. So it would be my experience is that more often than not that is happening, and I think the minority of the cases are the ones that are having the 1-to-1 ratios or the no one transfers at any cost. And so I would I think prior to going any further with this, having some real some data on what is really happening at all all levels, because at this point in our county, in our tri-county area, that we know that we're working together to meet the students' needs.
Okay, thank you. Is that Wingard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Morgan, you used the phrase stealing kids. Can you tell me who these children belong to?
Co-chairs, Representative Wingard, when I use the term stealing kids, I would kind of, maybe a poor choice of words, probably cherry-picking kids, attempting to recruit kids for athletics or other purposes. Our concern with the bill is that there's no limitation on that. There would be nothing prohibiting a school district from using taxpayer dollars to market their district or make improvements to their district in an attempt to bring students from neighboring districts into their school systems and, again, exacerbating the difference between the haves and have-nots. That's our concern.
So you suggested that it might be hurtful to rural schools, but I had a specific example in my own district. I represent, in total, at least half of the Westland Wilsonville district, the Sherwood district, and then a lot of the Washington County ones have some children in my district. But I have Gaston, which is a small, declining enrollment rural school that is trying to figure out this year how to cut $900,000 from a budget. But it's pretty much putting them on the edge of having to merge with another district. But this is something the people of Gaston do not want. They like their small rural school very much. Now, under this bill, they would be able to enroll children from some of the surrounding very large school districts that are near them that are currently prevented from being able to do that. And that might very well, because there are people attracted to the idea of, and they'll go out of their way to bring their kid to a child to a school they believe is a small rural community school. I think a bill like this has the potential to save some rural school districts and some rural schools, because there will be parents who are in suburban areas but within a reasonable distance of a rural school who will make the affirmative choice to do that, and they will keep districts like Gaston alive and viable. Would you like to comment on that?
Co-chairs, Representative Wingard, I'm not familiar with the tribulations of the Gaston School District. Under this bill, you're absolutely correct. The Gaston School District Board could say, we will accept any student who would like to come to our school district, and the school district where that student goes would have no say in that matter. And again, that's our primary concern, is that there's a balance within the inter-district transfer process right now where both school district boards and superintendents have an equal say in that process and can discuss and negotiate whether or not they want to exchange students. And I think on the whole, there are more districts that I think could have the potential to be damaged, where you go out to central or eastern Oregon or parts of the coast where there are a few what you would consider more medium-sized or urban-type school districts and lots of, you know, probably very small school districts that are struggling to provide comprehensive programs. You know, we've seen bills this session to try to get, you know, $8 million extra dollars to school districts. We've seen bills where, you know, school districts have foreign exchange students. So there are, you know, there's all kinds of, I think on the whole, there are more small school districts that are struggling to stay open, and we believe this would exacerbate that based on conversations with our folks.
Sure. This is a question for all three of you. But testimony was given that it's important to retain local control for school boards. So I would ask all three of you to comment. What's more important, local control for school boards or control for parents? The ability to have a choice. Which is the higher value?
Co-chairs and Representative Wingard, I think that it's a false choice to say that it has to be an either-or situation. I think there's a balancing act, and we've all testified to that. And I think that we're leaving out a part of the equation in asking the question that way, and that is all the other kids in the school, which is why I ended my testimony as I did, promoting the values for a few at the expense of the many, because when a district has a fiscal responsibility to balance the budget, it isn't just an exercise. It is about providing as high-quality education system as you can for the dollars for all kids. And so when kids leave the system in their resident school district for whatever reason, there will be an impact on the programs for the kids left in those districts. And I think that they and their interests ought to be considered in equal measure with those of the students seeking an alternate choice.
Follow up. Any others of you want to respond to that? Or? Okay.
So, Lori, with all due respect, it sounds like you're making an argument for defending certain boxes, because the reality is that even within a district, if they have to create a certain program for certain children, that's pulling money away from other things that are going on in the district. So this money moves around, and we do all sorts of specialized things already. So the idea that a child might move to a different district certainly means that some money will flow from one box to another. But I would make the Newtonian argument that it is not lost, it is simply transferred. And if that is the box that is going to work for that child, and if the parent believes that, and if time proves that, it just baffles me that we would be in the business of telling them no. Now, I have a constituent who moved out of moved across the Willamette River into another school district, which happened to be a declining enrollment school district. His children who had been attending in the Westland Wilsonville, they'd been attending grade school there. He wanted them to be able to continue that because they had friends there and they wanted to be able to do that. The superintendent of the new school district told him no. Every child is precious to us in a declining enrollment district, and so the answer is no. I'm wondering whose needs are being served when a superintendent responds that way.
I'll go back to Representative Hunt and Olson. I go back to my comment about that I don't believe that that's the case everywhere. In fact, I think it's a minority case. And so to have a bill like this go forward with as many obstacles as it will provide for districts without knowing whether or not the need for this bill is really this bill will fix the problem, and maybe the problem isn't as big as we think it is, but maybe it's a few people, a few districts that have certain policies and practices that and maybe a different solution might come up with. Because I do believe, in my experience, and that's pretty vast right now with working with 33 high schools, and that is, we do this. We do work together. We do meet the needs of our students, and we move students around, and we look at what they need and help them. So we are providing choice, and we are also being prudent with our school districts. So I without some sufficient data that says that it's not happening in districts around the state, this bill would be really difficult for most school districts who are doing the right thing and working and providing choice as well as solid programs. We don't have data that they're not. So that's my
final question. Okay.
Yep, last one.
So I hear a lot of concern about, well, first of all, when you make the statement that lots of people are doing this, then I'm not sure why this bill affects the people that are doing that. If districts already basically have a very open policy of letting students go, then this bill has no effect on them. It does ultimately then target those districts who perhaps are using monetary reasons or box concerns to prevent a parent and child from getting the choice that they think is going to work for them. I guess my final question is, When we entertain this fear of whether or not people will make other choices given the ability to make a different choice, I wonder why it doesn't, instead of the panicked response of no, why doesn't it ever invoke the internal probing question of why do people want to make another choice?
Representative Wingard, I think that is an excellent question. I'll respond in a couple quick ways. The first is, our organization advises all of our school districts that they should have we provide sample policies, and we, in an ideal world, every school district board and superintendent would consider each interdistrict transfer request on a case-by-case basis, and if the superintendent says no, we believe that the parents or the guardian should have an opportunity to go before the school board and make their case. There needs to be an appeal process. If we want to have a conversation about trying to ferret out some of the bad actors, we're certainly willing to do that. The problem is that the choice we're presented with here goes so far the other direction and creates so many other perhaps intended, perhaps unintended consequences to the system as a whole, that when we're presented with this specific response to the problem, we have no alternative other than to say no.
Mr. Chair, I would just make one final statement.
Okay.
just so that the committee and the audience is not left with the impression that some crazy idea is being proposed here. Oregon would not be the first, or the second, or the third, and I could go on, state in this union to have an inter-district transfer policy. And I believe that the public school systems in those states have not come to a crashing halt. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate you all coming up. And, Dana, you had stepped out when I called before, but you get the last word on this one. They'll about balance out time-wise the pro and the con.
Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, members of the committee, thanks so much. I'll be brief because I know some of you probably have some other things to do, and I know I do. So thanks for the opportunity. Oh, Dana Hepper, Stand for Children. Thanks for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3681. Stand for Children supports parents at least having some limited ability to choose, find the best educational setting for their child. We know many parents are already actively finding the best educational setting for their child. Lori outlined there are a lot of opportunities for parents to choose the best school for their child, the best teacher for their child in our education system as it stands right now. Some parents are doing this by moving to another school or district. Some physically buying a different house or renting a different apartment. Some are taking the risk under the current process of applying and taking the risk of getting rejected by their resident school district. Some are utilizing private schools. Many parents right now in Oregon, you will not be surprised, are using false addresses to claim that they live in a district where they do not live in order for their child to attend a school in that district. And some are applying to attend a school in another district and getting rejected under the current process and being left in the position to keep their child where they live, even if they find it's not the best fit for their child, as you just heard about. And I just wanted to, reinforce that House Bill 3681 is not new. Minnesota and Colorado are the two states that I'm most familiar with, and they've had this policy in place, from an open enrollment policy in place in their states for over 15 years. And I know that some of the concerns that Morgan Allen from OSBA outlined have come up in those districts. And what they've done is just over time, their law wasn't perfect when they passed it either, and over time they've been able to set parameters in their law and make amendments to their law over time that have made it work for them. And it seems to be functioning, and they're pleased with it, and certainly the parents of that state, it's helping them work for their helping them find the best educational setting for their children in that state. So that's all I have, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thanks, Representative Barnhart. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Are any of those parameters that you described in Minnesota present in this bill?
No. This bill is pretty simple, but I think this bill looks like what the first iterations look like in other states. And I think we do have time to add and change this bill over time. I don't think we're going to see in the first year of implementation in a piece of legislation like this a rush of parents from one district to another. I think this is a slow, fair, gradual change in a public policy, and it's safe to try it on for size and respond to what we find and set reasonable parameters in place over time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Chair, just simply a comment. If other states have already moved in this direction and established these kinds of policies, there's absolutely no reason why we can't learn from their experience and establish parameters that they have found to be useful, or at least explore them in the process of looking at a bill like this, rather than adopting a policy which is wide open without any of those sideboards that other states have found to be useful. I have an open mind on the topic, but I'm not prepared to support a bill that would simply open the door without the kinds of sideboards that other states have learned through their experience to be important and useful for the protection of our children. And I think, finally, let me just say that when I was on the school board in Eugene, Margaret Nichols, the then superintendent who died in office, said over and over again that our job is to do what's good for the kids. And I firmly believe that when we make educational decisions, that's what we have to do. These are tough decisions. They're not easy to do. I think there is merit on all sides of this kind of a question. I don't believe there's anything absolute about any of the proposals we're dealing with. And I sure would feel a lot more comfortable if we had a complete conversation about the experience of other states so we could consider some of the things that they've learned. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, it sounds like Representative Barnhart's interested in doing a little work group or something like that.
Mr. Chair, I didn't say that.
At least to look at Minnesota. Huh?
Can we vote on it? Okay, we appreciate you bringing this bill forward. Thank you all for staying extra late. I will close the public hearing. Yes, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3681. And the person from the department who needs to speak to Senate Bill 24 had to duck out, so we're going to carry over Senate Bill 24 to Tuesday. Fortunately, that's a Senate bill, so there's not the same kind of sense of urgency as there is around House bills. With that,
Mr. Chair, our next meeting is?
Next meeting, I believe, is Monday at 2:30, not 3. Monday at 2:30.
Thank you.
In this room. And you can come with your Sunday finest on because we're going to have a committee photo on Monday.
Oh, I appreciate the warning.
So I should mess up.
Has to be removed.
Representative Barnhart and I need to demist our foreheads, right, Representative Barnhart?
Come in.
Sorry?
You and I need to demist our foreheads.
I wish I knew how that could be done.
We are adjourned.
Do you have a photographer?